the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked.
Hello, this is Athena Melville. Welcome to Education Now. Belinda Rollins, midwife to Education Now, returns and joins me for this May 5th focus on media, technology, and education. It seems fitting that I launch this during Teacher Appreciation Week, as Belinda was my mentor in the area of media, technology, and education. Belinda is currently campaign and policy manager at NAMAC, the acronym for the National Alliance for Media, Art, and Culture, and she is the new field director for the Prometheus Radio Project, while she continues as director of the Transmission Project. She began her career in nonprofit work at the Cincinnati Art Museum and moved on to Media Bridges Cincinnati, which she transformed from a traditional public access television model into a media arts education center. Later, Belinda took on a traditional role as the executive director of the New Mexico Media Literacy Project, helping to strengthen the organization during the founding director's retirement. Drawn back to community radio, Belinda next moved to Northern California to head up Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, a rural community radio network with 6 facilities, 3 frequencies, and 125 volunteers. In 2008, she returned to the East Coast and became the executive director of the Transmission Project, where she currently works. Here, she works with media and technology nonprofits across the nation to build their capacity to better serve their communities. Belinda is trained as a facilitator in the technology of participation and as an interim executive leader. She also continues her work as a volunteer programmer, hosting her weekly radio show, Bubbles in the Think Tank. Belinda has served as NAMAC's board of directors and at the Prometheus Radio Project. She will lead a campaign to expand low-power radio, coordinating Prometheus staff and the People-Powered Radio Coalition to organize and support applicants for new low-power radio stations. Belinda attended the National Conference for Media Reform 2011, which was held in Massachusetts, in Boston, this past April, and we discuss that conference at length in this interview. The concept of net neutrality and the monopolization of the media by a small group is of paramount importance to both Belinda and I, and so we discuss that at length and its impact on education. So without any more discussion, we'll get on with the interview. And once again, if you'd like to comment, please send me an email at Hermes, H-E-R-M-E-S, at pacific.net, or connect to us through our Facebook page, Education Now's Facebook page. We love hearing from you there at the Facebook page, and we post constantly updates on what's currently happening in Education Now. So let's go, and I'll be back with you at the end for contact information for Belinda and for the things that we discuss, especially the FCC. Here we go. Hello, Belinda.
Hello, Athena.
Welcome back to Education Now. It's such a pleasure to
it's
have you.
It's always good to be here.
Oh, good. I am just delighted to be recording this so that I can share it with the listening audience at Education Now. And I wanted to start out by asking you how things were going at the Transmission Project, which you're the director of.
Well, the Transmission Project is actually in closed-down mode at this time. We lost our federal funding. The Corporation for National Service no longer seems to see the relationship between technology, media, and economics in low-income communities. So we have been defunded this year, and we have our last team of Digital Arts Service Corps members in the field, and when they wrap up at the beginning of August, that will be the end of the Digital Arts Service Corps.
So the Digital Arts Service Corps, the Transmission Project, will discontinue in early August of this year.
That is correct. And it's particularly sad, especially given that just a little bit over a year ago, when the FCC released the National Broadband Plan, one of their primary recommendations for broadband adoption in communities and for the economic health of communities was to start a National Digital Literacy Corps, which is essentially what the National Arts Service Corps, or the Digital Arts Service Corps, is. So, although it is a national priority at this time through the broadband plan to begin something like that, the project that already has existed in the field for 10 years and has many practices developed and resources cultivated, that is being defunded at the same time.
I see, because the last time that you were on, it seemed that, you know, it was just the perfect fit for what was needing to happen.
And it was. I believe that it continues to be. But, of course, that was a little over a year ago that we last spoke, right?
Right.
And I think we can all say that things have changed politically.
Oh, definitely.
In our nation's capital and elsewhere. And really, I just think that the stars weren't aligned for broad vision to mesh with resource allocation.
So does that mean that
you... Is that the nicest way I can possibly say that?
That is the nicest way that you could possibly say that. But I want you to know that at the end of this, I'm probably going to play a great song you introduced me to.
Good.
Because I'm quite annoyed. Does that mean that you will not be working through Volunteers in Service for America in the future?
That is correct. At this time, that is correct. I spent the past year, and you, as one of my great fans out there, are very well aware of how many trips to D.C. I made and to other various meccas of funding across the country. I spent a lot of time last year trying to plant the seeds for continuation to keep doing the work even without support from the Corporation for National Service. And it really just was not the best time in the economic and political environment to be able to actually fund a human resource to benefit the field.
Yes. So you attended the National Conference for Media Reform.
Correct.
That just happened, the National Conference for Media Reform in 2011, and certainly when you were there, you got a lot of information from your peers about experiences that they were having in this political environment and as well.
Right. You know, when the administration changed to 2.5 years ago, nearly now, I think that many of us on the ground were very hopeful as we saw some of our allies taking positions within the new administration, and we saw many of our priority interests actually rising up to be discussed, if not acted upon, at least discussed, from very simple communications access rights, such as making sure that all parts of the U.S. are connected by high-speed internet connections. From that to major corporate media consolidations, we believed that we had perhaps moved into an environment where those many of our priorities in those areas would be supported. But instead, we have a Comcast-NBC merger, the potential of an AT&T T-Mobile merger ahead of us. It's not exactly worked out as we had all hoped that it would.
No, and these mergers were happening, of course, before the past election. But the thought was that brakes were going to be put on this, and these monopolies were not going to be allowed to continue to get even bigger, and hopefully we would break them up. Because the media consolidation just does not lend itself to a free press. And
even with the conditions that were put on the NBC Comcast merger, for example, some of the commitments that were made through that process were never documented through the official approval process. So commitments were made purely on a handshake at some point. That would be there to support, local communities. And since they were never documented, there's really no accountability mechanisms in place for them. So some things were, but certainly not everything. And that doesn't necessarily bode well for how those processes will go forward. And we're certainly looking at the same situation with the AT&T T-Mobile merger, because T-Mobile currently is one of the lowest cost national level providers of mobile service, and AT&T is not. So the chances of T-Mobile customers being able to maintain lower rates is probably very unlikely, and it remains to be seen whether or not the merger is actually approved. I think it could go either way at this point, but it is something that there's a lot of work that's going to have to be done on the ground to protect that process.
I certainly hope so. I know that I get a lot of information, talking about they think they've stopped it, and it's like, you think you have, but have you? and it's just a very frightening time, and exciting. It's frightening and exciting because I listened in on a lot of the conference. I listened in on a lot of it and found it the broadband conference and found the broadband conference to be very exciting. And it didn't have just a lot of quote unquote progressives or left wingers there. At least what I was listening to, it seemed to me that it was drawing, that it drew a lot of really interesting voices together. And I enjoyed listening to it. I wondered, did people leave hopeful?
I would say people left with very mixed emotions.
Uh-huh.
on one hand, there, you know, there's some very hopeful things going on. For example, broadband stimulus funding that did get distributed and is currently being distributed throughout the country, you know, especially in Philadelphia and Detroit. Those are two very important broadband adoption projects to watch as things move forward. On one hand, you know, there are some really great things like that happening, but at the same time, we still, you know, we see defunding regulatory oversight through the budget process, which, you know, goes to the point of there may be rules on the books, but there's no funds with which to oversee those rules. So therefore, they, you know, for all intents and purposes, don't matter.
Right.
So there's, you know, there's pieces of the puzzle like that that come into play where you can have the rules, but if there's nobody enforcing them, then they don't really matter anymore. And that is part of the problem that we're going to see, you know, throughout this coming budget battle. Well, you know, one piece that everyone is very focused on the final annual budgets. And so, for example, the current year's budget that was just passed, you know, by the House and Senate for 2011, the year that is already half over. Before they got to that, they were passing the continuing resolutions to keep the government open until they could reach the final agreement. So in doing that, each time that they passed another continuing resolution, they would put various cuts on that process. And one cut that is really a substantial one for the public broadcasting community is the PTFP funding, which is public telecommunications facility funding. So it's money that helps small and rural radio stations upgrade transmitting equipment, buy emergency generators, emergency response equipment, things like that, to actually be able to serve more than anything. The rural communities rely on those funds, unlike any of the others. The money for the PTFP funds was completely stripped from the budget in one of the earlier continuing resolutions that happened. So it didn't even make it through to the final budget. It was stripped earlier. But in doing that, that happened at a point where no one is, you know, the public really isn't watching what's happening in a continuing resolution because, well, the media isn't reporting what's happening in the continuing resolutions beyond an agreement was reached to keep the government open two more weeks because there's no level of detail or analysis that happens as a general rule at this point. So there are issues like that that happen on a regular basis that are just so deep in the minutia of the bureaucratic process that they can't even, you know, come up through the noise to be known that they're happening.
Well, I can see why one of your favorite experiences at the conference there in Boston, the National Conference for Media Reform, was the panel, the Free Press panel that blasted the broken FCC, because the FCC is broken. If it can't,
it was a really nice panel because it had Gigi Sohn from Public Knowledge, who works a lot in intellectual property issues, copyright issues, but also, you know, merger issues, really protecting the public commons of property through media and technology. Then Malkia Cyril from the Center for Media Justice, whose sole goal is to eliminate poverty through telecommunications rights.
Mm.
And then having someone who actually is from the industry side, the founder of Skype was on that panel. So someone who, you know, who is providing a service that so many of us like, you're using it right now.
That's right.
And we use it, we value it, but they are a corporation, and they are, you know, they're on the Hill on a regular basis trying to make sure that policies are there that work for them. And, you know, for example, network neutrality is a very important issue for Skype because, for example, let's say another corporate internet provider said, well, we have our own voice over IP products that we want to prioritize over Skype data, so we're just going to slow down all the Skype data that goes through our network and instead make our voice over IP protocol move faster on our network. That's something that they are very concerned about. So having that sort of mix of voices, somebody very deep in the Beltway, Center for Media Justice is based in Oakland, much more grassroots-based, a very different take. They want the same things and take very different approaches in how to get there. And the ideas about how to fix the FCC, ranging from, you know, five-year limits on being able to return to industry or come out of industry into the FCC as, you know, for employment. Those sorts of issues, you know, play very heavily, whereas the fellow from Skype thought that 5 years, for example, would be way too long because then you wouldn't have people coming into the agency that understood the technology and where the industry was actually at. So how can you regulate it if you don't understand it, which is a big problem that we have on a regular basis as it is. People who don't understand the technology are the people in charge of regulating it.
Yeah, that's
designated by, you know, the greatest example of that is Ted Stevens when he was in charge of the committee that oversaw regulations, you know, the Senate committee that oversaw regulations of the Internet. Of course, he said, the Internet is not a dump truck, it's a series of tubes. That always being, you know, the great shining example of they don't get it.
Is there someone that gets it that, you know, is speaking to, you know, the broad public that you would recommend for our listeners?
You mean someone inside the administration?
Yeah.
Or, well, at the FCC, Commissioner Clyburn, I would say, is probably one of our greatest advocates. Commissioner Copps is still a great ally on the commission as well, but I don't believe he is going to be with the commission much longer. Whereas Commissioner Clyburn, she's a pretty recent addition. I think the only reason that she was able to get approved through the process, because of course anybody that serves on the Federal Communications Commission has to be approved by the Senate. I think the main reason she was able to get that position is because she had only served at the state level and really didn't have a record that showed her to be, you know, corporately and community leaning on either side. So even when she came into the role, many community groups, public interest groups were concerned about where she might land, and so was the corporate side. So that she was a very interesting pick, and really was a great choice because she was not from inside the D.C. Beltway, and was not really beholden to the special interests that so many other commissioners come in with.
Yes.
So she's a great advocate for public interest at the FCC, and she's always open. I think she's one of the most open commissioners as far as being willing to have conversations with constituents.
But they don't. But those two don't form a majority of the.
The FCC is always consists of three members of the president's party and two members of the other party. Of course, we can argue the merits of that, given that it's a two-party system and there's no opening for anything else to happen. But that is always the structure of the FCC. So the chair, in this case, Jenikowski, the chair is always of the White House party.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, so whatever party the president is, in this case Democrat, that will always be the majority of the FCC.
But
so that's the inherent structure of that. So right now it is a Democratic majority. But you never know it.
No, you never know it. And
You frequently will not know it. I shouldn't say never.
I'm just so glad.
They do on occasion do things, but I would say that Janikowski has not lived up to the
to our hopes.
The public interest community.
Right. And I'm just so glad. This is just really good that this is great, because whose pocket is he in terms of lobbyists? I mean, he must be under the influence of some big mega corporations if he is so unwilling to listen to the will of the people who want net neutrality.
Frequently.
And even the president has said he supports net neutrality. Is that just politicking, you know? Go ahead.
Ultimately, he will not be at the FCC forever. There's, you know, lots of speculation about how long anyone will be there. But, you know, ultimately, he will go back into the private sector and look for a new job. So even if he's not bought off in the first place, and this isn't necessarily a Janikowski-specific comment that I'm making, this is just the mechanism at hand. Even if he is not in anybody's pocket today, ultimately he's going to go out and look for a job. And where is that job going to be? It's going to be in the very industry that he was regulating. So there's, you know, there's just an inherent challenge there he's rulemaking today and then going to be looking for a job tomorrow. So whether or not there's any upfront money, there's always that question. And that goes to the issue of, for example, should there be a ban on, you know, or a limitation on how long somebody has to wait before they go back into the industry following a term at the FCC, or even coming into the FCC from the industry? It's that whole revolving door question that is usually asked around lobbyists, but really is across the board.
Gee, that's just, it makes me sort of understand why he's been so bizarre, because I just can't express the hope that there was on my part, and I think of many others who just see this net neutrality as so central to a democracy and so important to the process, and I just, you know,
it also comes back to, you know, to the framing of the message, because, for example, you know, we're currently in still, you know, an economic downturn that isn't necessarily showing any signs of going away anytime soon.
Right.
So if you look at the potential messaging around net neutrality, for example, and say that by not allowing internet network providers to manage the data traffic on their networks, you are by extension limiting their capacity to employ more people, because you're not allowing them to manage their network for, you know, maximum business efficiency. So if you take that message and lay it against, I need to be able to see all of the YouTube videos I want to see, which I know, I mean, that's a very simplistic, you know, counter argument, but it's one that we actually hear. I want to be able to hear whatever radio station I want to hear on the internet. I want to make sure that, you know, whatever the issue is, when you take them in this particular economic climate, you can see where one probably will gain more sway with people who don't really understand the technological mechanisms behind these issues. There's a session from the Free Press Conference that was titled "What's the next phase of net neutrality?"
Uh huh.
And one of the people on that panel was one of the people who did actually invent the Internet, who actually designed the technical infrastructure of how the system would work. And he has such a fascinating take, because he knows from the inside, because he built it, what technologically is possible and not possible based on the way that the system was built. So, you know, there's always issues about, you know, what kind of devices will help or hinder the system, where management log, network management log jams will happen and won't happen. But he's just fascinating, because he knows where the log jams can and cannot happen, and will call them very clearly. And I highly recommend, if you go and watch anything in that conference, the session that he's in is really one of the most fascinating, in my opinion, because he does really talk about mechanically, what does all this mean?
Yes, our audience.
In a way that's understandable.
Mm-hmm.
He's very down to earth about it.
Oh, that's great. That's exactly what I wanted to hear. Now, the listeners can access what happened at the National Conference for Media Reform this past month there in Boston, because it's all been archived, right?
Yes, I believe all of the sessions are online.
Right, and that's just
front page of freepress.net. There are links to the conference and the video at the conference.
Okay, from the Free Press.
Freepress.net.
Freepress.net. If you go to freepress.net, you can get all of the you can get access to the archive for the broadband for the conference.
The National Conference for Media Reform.
If you go to freepress.net, is that right?
Yeah.
Thank you so much. So let's talk about what you're doing now. You're still with transmission until August, with Transmission Project through Vista. But what are you going to do next? I want to talk about your new job at the National Alliance for Media, Art, and Culture. As a campaign and policy manager?
That is correct.
Oh, that's...
Well, NAMAC is a membership organization that's been around since 1980, and they have a diverse membership of arts and media organizations across the country. All independent media arts organizations are eligible to join. They conduct research that's helpful for the field. For example, right now we're doing a mapping project of media organizations across the country. We try to create different opportunities for members of the field to come together through conferences, leadership trainings, and various opportunities like that. And they're really one of the few organizations in the field right now that are doing leadership trainings, as many organizations, the leadership of those organizations are starting to age out, trying to do some leadership development opportunities to find the next generation of leaders in the field. And then the newest emphasis of the organization is increased advocacy on behalf of the field. So that is where I come in. So by taking this position as the campaign and policy manager, I'll be working on their key policy arenas, which include network neutrality and access to broadband technology.
Yes,
those are key, especially for artists. This is it's a very arts focused organization, and when you think about where content comes from, it's all created by independent makers or corporate makers, but we're there to represent the media artists and the media makers.
Yeah.
So net neutrality.
If there's anything that speaks to the individual, it's the arts. I mean, corporate art is so plastic. So I think it's a beautiful fit. I mean, in terms of net neutrality, the artist. I think journalism is an art form as much as, you know, as it is a science. And so there's a very strong connection. I couldn't help but pick up on what you said.
And then, you know, and also in the priority areas for policy are public and private arts funding. So we're interested in funding through the National Endowment for the Arts, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, funding sources in the public arena and in the private arena. So we're looking to build arts infrastructure to make sure that that infrastructure is there for local communities to better their economies and increase learning and achievement opportunities, and also allow more people to experience art within their own communities and over the Internet. So funding, of course, is a very important part of this process. And then creative freedom of expression. We're, you know, we look at issues around corporate threats to freedom of expression through lawsuits against individuals and organizations, fair use issues, copyright issues. These are all very important parts of protecting freedom of expression, so that artists and media makers can continue to get out messages and create meaningful artworks that that serve their communities to the best of their ability.
Yes, and so will you be doing a lot of fundraising or training in this position? When it says campaign and policy manager, I'm curious
I'll be doing sort of a three-pronged approach. The primary approach to this is to institute a campaign and policy institute, which would be a multi-day training opportunity for arts administrators to go to D.C. and learn about how to design advocacy campaigns for the field and for their organizations. At the organizational level, a lot of arts organizations around the country are being threatened, not just through all of everything that we pay attention to at the federal level, but also state arts organizations are being cut and eliminated.
I know.
Local funding at municipal levels for arts. Also under great threat.
Yes.
There's a lot of different problems like that out there that arts administrators aren't necessarily well equipped to deal with as these challenges come up. So NAMAC wants to organize the Campaign and Policy Institute to bring leaders together to teach them how to address these issues and give them real life opportunities to do, you know, to meet with elected officials and agency representatives in D.C. To get that experience of being able to go as a constituent to talk to elected officials. And then also to look at the mechanism of organizing their at-home constituency to organize when these threats arise and even before they arise. So
wow.
That's one piece of it. Another piece will be to do ongoing development at the national level so that, for example, a local arts administrator who can't make it to that very limited multi-day training in D.C. can still participate in webinars, conference briefing calls, various peer training circles, so that organizations can learn from each other about how to do this kind of work in the field. So we'll be doing some surveying of the field to find out where the needs are. For what kind of training might be needed and wanted at the organizational level. And then, of course, working with our partners in the field, like the Future of Music Coalition, Arts Advocacy Day, organizations like that, to really be able to advocate on behalf of our membership of arts media and arts organizations to do the work at the federal level to protect those policy issues that we're concerned about.
Could you mention those two groups again?
Well, we've got a number of partners. The ones I mentioned, Future of Music Coalition.
Of Music Coalition.
Yes, they're very focused on the musicians community, trying to help musicians to be able to do radical things like earn a living, pay for a place to live,
yeah.
They believe artists should be able to have, you know, be able to pay their mortgage and have health insurance.
Yeah.
So they are very active in that. In the fall, Future of Music, and I'll remember to send you information when the dates come out. They host a policy summit in D.C., and the vast majority of that is online also. And it's a very interesting meeting of musicians and artists, policy wogs, and organization administrators all coming together to talk about music and national policy that affects musicians. So it's a really fascinating event. And we also partner with the Media and Democracy Coalition. That's a coalition of around 36 public interest groups around the country that work in many different arenas of media and telecommunications policy, both at the national level and at the grassroots level.
Media and
Democracy Coalition.
Okay, Media and Democracy Coalition. So, well, shall we move now into an article that you sent me from the Benton Foundation, you know, on Ready to Learn?
Sure. What did you think of the Ready to Learn report, Athena?
Well,
I'm very curious.
It was short. And it's sort of...
59 pages?
Well,
no. I thought it was thin, but not necessarily short.
Well, there's the good word. There's the good word, thin. You know, that it reaffirms... what it says is that the report reaffirms the PBS and the U.S. Department of Education reaffirm the important role that public media plays in educating children ages 2 to 8. And I thought that that was good, but, you know, with a lot of this, I think that what they leave out is how important it is that there be somebody that facilitates this experience, just like any other kind of learning. You know, these
I thought that was one of the most interesting part of the report.
Is
because they examined not only the very specific impact of programs, and of course, you know, programs that included refunding of things that we think about regularly, like Reading Rainbow and Sesame Street, but also revived funding for Electric Company, which is one of those shows that I grew up with.
Right.
I certainly watched Electric Company all the time.
Yes, so did my kids.
Anything like the old one.
Pardon?
Which is good. I said the new one sure doesn't look anything like the old one.
Uh-huh.
But they went beyond just the examination of skills developed by watching the programs to increasing achievement through outreach activities around the programming. So they funded, in addition to the programs, various activities like summer camps, where they brought children together with educators and opportunities to do expanded learning around the shows. It was really, I was glad to see that they focused beyond just the program itself. And I think really what they did was just solidify what people like yourself know very clearly, that although, yes, the programming can have an impact, you know, for an individual child, that impact will be magnified greatly if there is an active adult or community to support that learning beyond the program. So it sort of looked at that first level of, well, even backing up, it looked at, you know, control groups of no program watched to I'm in a Head Start and watching the program. I'm in a Head Start that does program, you know, or does activity around the program that is watched to, you know, what happens at home around the program that is watched. And so that I think I'm very pleased that the Department of Education finally funded some research around these things, but I just believe that they didn't necessarily find anything that people who already know, but certainly that they showed the difference it can make in a low literacy household where parents or caregivers don't necessarily feel like they are at a personal literacy level that can support the learning that they want to support for their children. And they really showed what public media can do to support that in those households that don't feel that they have the time or the personal skill set with which to support them.
Well, I think that where I was at with it was not that there's anything wrong with what's here, is what's missing. And what's missing is how important it is, first of all, just like you were talking about, the parents or the caregivers of these kids not feeling like they themselves have the skills to give. But if they are given the skills, then their impact on the learning is even more significant. Mm-hmm. And that can Changing Brains series, which is free and people can view it on the internet. You can hear the interview on Education Now. You see how important it is for the caregivers themselves to be involved in that process. And so I would say that is what I didn't find. And even with Save the Children, they know when out there, when they're going out there now, they're going to the caregivers and giving them the tools to do this instead of like trying to do it, you know, with the kids or with the technology. It's not that you don't use the technology. It's just that it's a total process there, where you're empowering the caregivers, which further empowers the students, and you're using that the technology as well. And then the other thing that was not here, I didn't see, was the importance of play. Because when it's a crucial element in all of this. And although you see the kids playing on Sesame Street and you see the playing, you know, the importance of those kids who are watching it and interacting with it, that they play, is not, there isn't an emphasis on that. So that would be what I would say. Everything else, I think it's good, and maybe that's where you were going when you said it was thin. But, I don't have any problem with it, except that I felt like there were these pieces missing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, I think I probably spent most of the time reading about the community engagement programs, that portion of the report, because that really did seem, I really felt like they weren't covering any new territory in the program. They were able to actually document for the first time that, yes, these programs do have significant and specific impact in literacy levels. And it was nice to finally see that measured, because we have, in this kind of work, we have so few measurements to be able to use when push comes to shove and we're trying to prove that what we do matters. So it was great to finally have some data on that end. Yeah, but really where I was most interested, because I think it's something that is sometimes harder to fund because of the fact that there's more human involvement, is really the engagement programs that try to engage programs as well as the children. So that was where I think I spent a lot of my time looking at this. Showing that, by having, for example, a summer reading camp that included creating literacy superheroes. The kids would create their own literacy superheroes and do a lot of role playing around programs that they're working with. One of the stats was that they had a 112% gain in word decoding over children who just watched the program without having a community camp experience that supported that.
Uh huh.
I
can understand that. I mean, if you whenever you act it out, whenever you part of history or even a scientific, even something in science like the way that a protein behaves, you know, when you act that out, it your whole body is involved in the learning. So, you know, that makes all kinds of sense to me and would to, I think, most teachers. I mean, I would hope that, so I guess that was sort of, yeah, for sure, you know, that would be true. And I think it's great that they have those kinds of camps and that kind of thing is happening. But it, once again, I don't think it's a new thing.
No.
But did you see what Jenikowski's new media, the new media is better suited to educate kids than a broadcast model? Did you see that part? I was like, now better, you know, like why not either? Why not both? Why is it either or?
And that was something that this report really was really focused on. You know, if you take any one of the mechanisms, you know, any one of the tools by itself, it may be good. But when you combine the tools with the human component,
yeah,
it's the best.
Yeah.
And I think that's always the lesson. Just as, you know, I know you and I talked in one of our previous conversations about, you know, what is media literacy, but watching some media and then talking about it. And that's the most helpful way to consume media.
Right.
By not just consuming it and being done with it, but actually, you know, taking it through that next step of processing it.
Right.
With whatever community it is that you want to process it with.
Yeah, well, I know that a lot of there's a lot of concern about how much screen time kids have, and you know I watch my students and I watch my granddaughters and they're all so much more proficient at this than I am, and I see that they are very social, they're very physical, they have a positive attitude towards life. I don't see that it has hurt them at all to have the screen time, because I do think that they have those primary relationships, and I just get so tired of having to fight with people who are so anti-technology and they don't think it's natural. I mean, all of these things are just so frustrating, and so that you can't get on with, gee, look, you know, you can't move forward because there's this dead weight of people who don't want to even accept technology. They don't want to follow the kids, which, you know, years we've known that's what you do. You know, if you follow the child, then, you know, you're right in the pocket there. They want to say, oh, technology bad, screen time bad, bad. And so we can't, with a lot of people, we can't even get that far, Belinda. And so I enjoyed the Ready to Learn. I did feel that the aspect of play wasn't central, and I do feel that people pick and choose what they want. And my fear, as I told you before, is that with communities of color and in communities where there's a lot of poverty, what they'll pick is to see how using this can increase standardized test scores, but it can't really. And And then they'll force feed instead of making it a fun process, you know, in the whole play of things. That's the fear. And there is evidence that that is happening in some school districts. But and in some learning environments for children. Well, all blah blah, all of that. Before I let you go, because I know you have to go, and I just want to thank you so much for coming on again, and wish you all success and with a new adventure there at the National Alliance for Media, Art, and Culture, and finishing up there with the transmission project. I'll hope to hear lots more from you. And I want to tell you and the listening audience how much I enjoy Bubbles in the Think Tank.
Oh, thank you.
Which is Belinda's radio show every Saturday night out of the WMFO Tufts Radio there in Massachusetts, in Boston, or Medford.
You know, I don't really mention the mission statement of the radio show. You don't meet many people who have a mission statement for their radio show. We wrote one many, many years ago, and at the time we thought it was funny, and today I think that it remains really, you know, central to the show, and it's to promote personal growth and literacy through telecommunication. We probably wrote that as our mission statement for the show back in the 80s, and we did that because we used to run a Mad Lib game. So there was the call-in Mad Lib game component where people had to give words, and we had so many young callers, you know, early teens, who were staying up way too late at night and calling this crazy radio show. But so we were trying to figure out a way to describe, you know, and how could they, like, you know, if they got busted by their parents in the middle of the night, how could they justify it? And so we thought, oh, if we have, like, this, you know, really good-sounding mission statement, that would be a way that people could, you know, that a listener could say, oh, well, this is a productive thing. This isn't a useless waste of my time. And so that was what we did. But I think that that sort of helped to inform what kind of direction I wanted to take with it for the for the rest of my life.
For Bubbles in the Think Tank.
Right, because I've done the show more than half of my life.
Yes. Well, I just think it's a wonderful show, and I listen whenever possible on Saturday nights over the...
And we love having you there.
Oh, yeah. I listen over the web, so anyone can really listen to Bubbles in the Think Tank, WMFO. And it it's at 11 o'clock Eastern time, so I tune in at 8 because it's 8 o'clock Pacific time, and so much fun, and I love the obituaries that Belinda does at the second hour of the show, especially. I love those. It's just such a wonderful tribute, but it's so much fun, and in today's political climate, it's, you just really need to laugh, and I find that I do get a laugh, and I have a lot of fun, and I thank you for that, Belinda. I thank you for all that you do, and I thank you for being my guest and the midwife for Education Now, and I hope we'll do it again soon.
And I thank you for being my friend for all of these years.
Oh, I love you. Goodbye, Belinda.
Thanks a lot.
Have a wonderful evening.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. I certainly hope you enjoyed the interview with Belinda Rollins on media, technology, and education as much as I enjoyed bringing it to you. And before I go on, I want to say that Belinda's has a new job she's taken on as well with the Prometheus Radio Project, and she had not taken on that responsibility at the time of our recording of this interview, and so that's something new, and I will give you contact information for Belinda at the end here. But before I go on with the outro, I want to share with you a song that Belinda and I really both enjoy and that she introduced me to regarding the FCC as I promised in the beginning of this interview. So let's go on with that and then I'll be back.
My country used to be sweet land of liberty that once was true. Until the FCC shows what we hear and see on radio and on TV. FCC, FU. When you deny a choice, you censor every voice. That's what you do. We say, go fly a kite, but that's far too polite for stealing First Amendment rights. FCC, FU. What makes your ass so tight? Does the religious right rule over you? Those few fanatic fools and your outrageous rules kick freedom in the family jewels. FCC, FU. Soon those misguided kooks will all be burning books with help from you. Why be so meddlesome? Must you assume we're dumb? What is it you protect us from? FCC, FU. Are we all so repressed that one small glimpse of breast must be taboo? One Janet Jackson boob botched up what's on the tube. Bend over, we're not using lube. FCC, FU. It's time we take a stand, shout it through all the land. We can't stand you. And while we fight this fight, we can say with delight that ours gone to satellite. FCC, FU. What I hear, what I see, please leave that up to me, not up to you.
Well, I certainly hoped you enjoyed the song on the FCC. I just really enjoyed that song. And I want to say, right now is a good time for me to say to you that to connect with the Federal Communications Commission, or the FCC, you go to www.fcc.gov. And with the proposed merger of AT&T and their hopes to monopolize everything, if you go to freepress.net, you can find an article on that, and you can help by signing a petition to on this to stop the T-Mobile from being bought by AT&T, and you can sign a petition at 3Ws, thepetitionsite.com/to-stop-t-mobile-from-being-bought-by-att. So I hope that that's helpful to you. I'm sure that if you go to the petition site and look for a petition on stopping T-Mobile from being bought by AT&T, that you will find it. And now for some contact information for Belinda, if you want to contact her through the Transmission Project, it's transmissionproject.org. If you want to contact her through the National Alliance for Media, Art, and Culture, it's 3Ws.NAMAC.org. If you want to contact her through the Prometheus Radio Project, it's 3Ws, Prometheus Radio, PROMETHEUSRADIO.ORG. And if you'd like to connect with Belinda through her radio show, Bubbles in the Think Tank, on Saturday evenings, you can do it via the web at 3Ws.BubblesInTheThinkTank.com is where you'll find her archive and the call letters for listening to the show out of Medford, at WMFO. Now, some other contact information and references that we used during this interview: the National Conference for Media Reform 2011 archive, as we said, can be accessed through 3ws.freepress.net. Just look for National Conference for Media Reform 2011 archive. And the person that Belinda was talking about, who she said really, you know, was the head of the beginning of the Internet, his name is David Reed, and you can access a discussion with him at the National Conference for Media Reform by going to http://conference.freepress.net/session/480/ probably the best thing to do is just to find ask for the conference on David Reed, and you should be able to find it there. Or if you go to the Facebook, if you go to our site on the Facebook page, you will find that I have listed there all of these references, and then it would be clickable for you if you want to access the David Reed, who, you know, was at the forefront of the Internet, which Belinda was talking about in the interview. That, I think, is the best way to do it. And then we discussed Ready to Learn, the Benton Foundation, and you can access that information at benton.org. That's BENTON.ORG. And when you're there, look for the Ready to Learn information. Well, thank you so much for joining me for tonight's launch. And if you didn't, whenever you happen to be listening to this, and Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education. a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. All shows and podcasts on Education Now are available for free download or listening anytime after our launch at the website. Education Now broadcasts are also listed in the events calendar on the American Montessori Society website at www.amshq.org in the events pages. Thank you again, and I hope that you'll join me in helping to get net neutrality. That's my quest, net neutrality. Thank you so very much. Bye now. Until next month.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by. And so, become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.